So, very good evening, everyone. Almost every evening these days, I'm very fortunate to spend time with people who have been practicing and studying the Buddha's teachings. And all of them, throughout the world, express as well as show great interest in learning the Dharma, some as a very dedicated, formal Buddhist practitioner, and many of them not necessarily a Buddhist, although I think in the beginning stages, probably it's more easier to define whether one is a Buddhist or not a Buddhist, because within Buddhism there are all of the different forms, as well as traditional practices, vows and precepts, and all those necessary formalities through which a person may refer to oneself as a Buddhist or not. But the more you get into the Buddhist studies, and the more you begin to spend time really trying to understand what the Buddhist teachings are about, there comes, hopefully, most of us will realize a time where we begin to clearly understand that the designation of being a Buddhist is not reliant upon a form, as much as if one were to truly understand and deepen one's understanding of the meaning of what the Buddhist teachings are about, then a person would be much more able to comprehend that it is everything about human mind and the development of human potentials and qualities. So at a certain point, I think even reference to being a Buddhist no longer is very relevant. However, as the system is that we have begun to create and the system that we live in, there are lots of people who refer to them as Buddhist practitioners. Some have some hesitancy referring to them, but overall there is immense growth and interest in trying to cultivate meditation, mindfulness, awareness, and a sense of appreciation for all of those teachings, Buddhist and other traditions, that may be helpful in introducing oneself to the concepts of how we can, as a human being, develop better qualities, better potentials, and not only introduce oneself, but to also take support from the many different methods that are there. Today, what is very prevalent, a word that is used, is contemplative science or meditation. And so that interest, that growth being, I think, on the increase, many people say so, and we have, you know, especially someone like me who spends, as I said, most of the evenings with people with that interest, there does seem to be a growing interest, which is, I think, absolutely wonderful. Because in the context of the world that we have today, and the speed with which the changes occur, the rapid changes that are occurring, and the different sort of radical changes that happen globally, socially and economically, of course we all feel a sense of chaos and an imbalance. And if the world is to continue displaying human awareness and human qualities, good qualities, and be able to coexist with fair amount of sanity, then I think it will be very important that there is this push and encouragement given to contemplation, given to meditation, not necessarily Buddhist, but anything that evokes in the human mind introspection and reflection upon knowing the qualities of a human being through which much of one's own peace and contentment and happiness can be located intrinsic, rather than constantly pursuing the source of happiness, assuming it to be on the external side. So with that, I think it's very good that there is an increased interest, there is a sense of people coming together to making it possible that there is an outreach where we can share with one another some of the wonderful teachings. And one of these wonderful teachings being the teachings of Shakyamuni Buddha, which we today refer to as being Buddhist teachings. And so that's, I think, wonderful, and to the Dhamma Study Group as well as others who are from the various other meditation centers, I'm deeply grateful for the effort that is continuously being put in by so many wonderful people. But at the same time, now if we were to talk about more the Buddhist people, because I don't know much of anyone else and how they function, my life is much more sort of connected to the Buddhist world. And so while on the one hand, as I began speaking, there is the growth interest, and that it is good that there is the growth and interest in human qualities and the development of human qualities. But on the other hand, if we speak about a group of people, such as the Buddhist practitioners, who are trying to dedicate a whole part of their life and tremendous diligence and effort and concentration into learning these different forms through which such human potentials and human qualities can be developed. But how many of them are able to come out from the realm of intellectually appreciating these qualities to truly being able to integrate them into their lives? Now, that's a challenge that's always there. Jokingly, I always talk about the, you know, Buddhists, especially Western Buddhists, who for years have tried to convince someone like me that it is possible to balance both this world and their spiritual path, what we call samsara and nirvana. And for many years, my very good old Western Buddhist friends, they tried to always give me the image of a lotus that grows very pristine and pure, untainted by the muddy water in which it is born. However, my take on that is it's a very beautiful image, mental image, but much of the lotus tends to be very splattered by the muddiness in today's times. And that's where we look at probably no one else but one's own self, where we have wonderful philosophies of the world. But if those wonderful philosophies of the world are appreciated, and yet the appreciation is from a much more simplistic, naive approach, then what happens is we have profound, lofty theories, but not necessarily those lofty, profound, meaningful theories are able to come down to the ground where they can truly and very directly bring about proper and good changes that are some things, the benefits of which are accessible directly to oneself and to the others. So therefore, on the one hand, where there is an increase to really meditate, develop mindfulness, cultivate qualities such as loving kindness and compassion. However, the danger of it is that very, very oftentimes people like the idea, but they like it and then they have an approach which is, I think, very simplistic. Now, simplistic approach here, I do not mean simplicity as a good thing. I see simplicity in this context as being rather naive about their approach to what the understanding of loving kindness and compassion or human qualities are about. For example, when there is talks or teachings, meditation, by very eminent teachers, particularly, let's say, His Holiness the Dalai Lama, and when there's a tremendous amount of push to the cultivation of compassion, loving kindness, altruism, tonight's topic being the four immeasurables, which consists of four very profound qualities: loving kindness, compassion, joyfulness, and equanimity. And there are hundreds of books available on that. There's probably nothing that can be said that is not something you can easily access on Google, for example. You type compassion and you get files upon files of different ways in how many different ways one can cultivate the kindness and loving kindness and all of these altruistic great qualities. But the problem is about the simple approach, where the simplicity and the interpretation that is more inclined towards simplicity almost gives a sense where individuals may misunderstand the concept of compassion, or the concept of any good human qualities. Since we're talking about the four immeasurables, I'm going to then zero down on the word loving kindness or compassion. Because where the simplistic approach is applied, then oftentimes cultivating of these profound qualities, such as loving kindness and compassion, can be almost like wearing a costume over an old body. It's the same body. And then that's sort of an analogy given of an old body or the same body wearing different costumes, different disguises. If the mind of the individual has this simplistic approach in regard to these qualities, then we try to, in that context, cultivate compassion upon a mind, superimposing compassion upon a mind that even before it actually engages in anything compassionate, has already determined that it's not going to change. So I'm going to superimpose loving kindness upon myself, and I will try to project that loving kindness or compassion, but it is going to be somewhat not deep enough that it is going to completely come from the depth of who I am as a human being. So when there is a distance, when there is a gap between the person and the quality that we are trying to cultivate, then what happens is over time we become religious people with an allegiance to a profound philosophy that we hold in high regard. But that profundity and the meaning of that very profound philosophy never is able to have the limbs, so to speak, as an example, that can reach out, and the benefits of which are directly accessible to oneself and to the others. And so therefore, it is in this context that what I would like to do this evening with regard to the four immeasurables is to just lay out what these four immeasurables are. Not just as a beautiful sort of nice Friday evening, on a summer Friday evening where we have nothing to do, so we're all going to get into a beautiful church and talk about changing the world and spreading loving kindness and compassion, but to get a sense of the hard work that is actually involved when we get into cultivating a profound quality that you and I hold as being truly good and beneficial and really something that is of profound benefit to self and others. So therefore, the first thing is, the question that I would like to ask is, do you think it's worth developing the four immeasurable qualities? Because if you think it's not worth developing the four immeasurable qualities, then that's the end of the talk. You know. So loving kindness in your own mind, not as a Buddhist, not as a religious person, not as anyone but a thinking human being. Do you intrinsically feel a strong affinity to the quality of loving kindness as a quality that you do associate with finding it for yourself from others, or as an expression of something that you would like to give to others? Likewise, with the quality of compassion, how do you feel about compassion? Do you merely see compassion as just a theory that is a subject of some curiosity or experiment? Or is there an intrinsic affinity, closeness, that you do feel a strong affection for the quality of compassion, either as that quality that you would like to be a recipient of, or as a quality that you would like to express towards, if no one else, then towards your loved ones? Similarly, do you feel that there is worth in cultivating that quality called joyfulness? And joyfulness, there's nothing very deep, mysterious about the word. It's just being joyful. Do you appreciate being happy? Do you appreciate being able to have a good laugh that you would like to enjoy, that you would like to see others enjoy or perhaps share? And likewise with the fourth quality, equanimity. Would you like to be, now, what is equanimity? Would you like to be peaceful? Would you like to get a good night's sleep? Would you like to stay out of trouble? Would you like to just be quiet and still and be harmonious, intrinsic, and be able to experience that harmony external of one's own self? First, probably the question would be is your own relationship to these words and whether you think that these are worth exploring, worth contemplating upon, worth listening to and learning about, so that you will be able to see the benefits of producing these qualities within one's own self. Because that will determine the journey that you wish to take. If it is a destination that you're not really interested in taking, it's going to always impact the actual movement of walking on the path of the practices. Therefore, it is very essential to spend some time really looking into one's own self and trying to understand the benefits and trying to understand the worthiness of the qualities, such as, since we're talking about the four immeasurables here too. This is then again very similar to even the concept of meditation. For example, when people sort of dive into cultivation of mindfulness and meditation, and it's very popular today to say, oh, it's very good to meditate, it's very good to develop mindfulness and so forth. It is good, but it may not be necessarily something you've thought out very well. For that matter, jokingly these days, I always say, people today when they talk about, and lots of times we always say, Buddhism is increasing. People are appreciating Dharma and people are turning to meditation increasingly. I've always taken that with a little bit of skepticism because it's the first week of romance. It's almost like you've just fallen in love with someone. And when you fall in love with someone, you don't see the blemish of it. You only see the good things. Even if the person who's staring at you has purple hair and, you know, all kinds of different kinds of what we call extraordinary embellishments, let's say, isn't it? But when you fall in love, you disregard that. There's very much the feeling of love. In the same way, meditation and being calm and peaceful and loving and generating compassion and doing good for the others and being more aware are all very good. I'm not arguing with that fact. But if you look at it from a very rose-tinted glasses, as you say in English, then what happens is you're looking at it from the perspective where after the initial romantic stage, you'll begin to recognize the hard work that is involved. And the hard work is nobody else's but yours. And that's what makes Buddhism, I think, increase in the first phase, but then there's a dip. And the dip is so steep because the dip is what will never make Buddhism very popular. Because it is the only philosophy that doesn't have anyone to blame but your own self for anything that is wrong. Neither is there anyone more responsible for producing anything good but your own self. And it's not always favorable to a human mind to be put on that spot. We are conditioned, civilizations, culture, social upbringing, and the way the world has been designed. We are conditioned in such a way where we hold either one or some people or circumstances responsible for our situation. We have politicians to blame, we have God to blame, we have prophets to blame, we have religious masters to blame, we have people to blame, we have the original sin to blame, we have many things to blame, we have karma to blame. However, to be able to come to a point where you see that that blame no longer is actually logical, everything is dependent upon you, your own self, that is very difficult. Now, when we speak about it, it doesn't seem to be. When you're put on that spot, it will be. And so therefore, when we come to that very crucial point of individual responsibility, it becomes very difficult to begin to walk on the path. And the only way to counteract that is to be able to spend time prior to beginning to walk the path, to really take time to sort of think and understand whether or not what you are trying to cultivate is worth it. It is beneficial. you really understand the value and the meaning of what you are undertaking. So in this case, such as compassion. For example, let's begin with a very simple quote that the Buddha himself said. In the middle length Prajnaparamita, we find a quote where the Buddha says, anyone who is unable to join one's own mind with the four causes or the four sources of human sanity are constantly bound within the confusion of cyclic existence. We find traces of the Buddha's appreciation for the four immeasurables: cultivation of loving kindness, compassion, joy, and equanimity, mentioned in the sutra teachings as the four sources of human sanity, something that will keep the human mind sane. And that without these four bases or sources of sanity, a mind is constantly trapped in the cyclic existence, which we call samsara. And for those who are not familiar with the term samsara or just cyclic existence, another very simple way to approach it is the unending game of hope and fear. That's what samsara is. So therefore, in the beginning, when we discuss the four immeasurables, it becomes essential to really be able to see that these four, loving kindness, compassion, joy, and equanimity, are not necessarily certain qualities that which, when you wish to, you impose upon yourself or the others. It's not about waking up and say, today is a nice day, I'm going to be lovingly kind to others. Or I'm going to go out and see who needs my compassion. Or I'm going to be in equanimity, or I'm going to develop joyfulness. Not in that approach. But to be able to see these four not as expressed emotions, but more as the source of one's own basic sanity, basic awareness. Therefore, from that approach, some of the great masters, and particularly Lonchenpa, one of the great masters of Tibetan Buddhism, describes the source of these four immeasurables in the cultivation of what are called five qualities. He says, you can never actually even imagine talking about kindness, compassion, joyfulness, or equanimity if you do not let these originate from five characteristics of your own mind. Mind, that is vast, not mind, attitude that is as vast as the expanse of space. That's the first one. If one's own nature is not as constant as the depth of the ocean, that's the second characteristic. One who is unable to regard every day's experiences, inner and external, as mists floating in the sky. That's the third characteristic. Someone whose own attitude, compassionate attitude, is not even as the rays of the sun. That's the fourth characteristic. And the fifth is someone who is unable to deal or see negativities as a speck of dust in one's own eyes. That is the fifth characteristic. In simple words, if one does not develop the basic foundation of these five attitudes or personalities in one's own self, speaking about then going out to being lovingly kind and compassionate to the others, then is, you know, as I said, very simplistic. Now, just to support what I have said about simplistic, I'll give you an image so that you can hold on to that image through the talk that we have this evening. If you are sent to war against a huge army that is very well equipped with all the modern gadgets and weapons, missiles and guns and all things that you can think of, and there are thousands against you as the force of the enemy, and you are the ones that I send you to war, singular, yourself, and the only weapon I will give you is a potato peeler. A potato peeler, of course, a very good potato peeler, you know, That's really effective and can peel many, many potatoes very effectively. And you stand in front of that army, thousands, well equipped with all the modern weapons. Here is the image that I will ask you to hold in terms of saying, what you have is a good weapon. It's a wonderful potato peeler that has the best characteristics of any potato peeler can have. But at the same time, you are not going to be as confident about your winning the battle. Why? It's because what you have, although is good in itself, still cannot withstand the forces that are against you. Naive interpretation of any quality is quite similar to holding that potato peeler. It's a good thought. Loving kindness is very good, of course. His Holiness the Dalai Lama speaks about compassion. So we're all going to be compassionate. That's very nice, but the lifespan of that nice idea is at the most a week. After that, one's own patterns, neuroses, habits, one's own hopes and fears. This is then similar to the analogy of the enemy in front of one's own self. That have had tremendous strength, momentum, and power gained through usage, occurrence, again and again, and such a familiarity that it is so strong that you, even with your wish to be loving and kind and compassionate, can never actually always withstand the forces of habitual neuroses that come in great force against one's own self. Therefore, to be able to come out of that naiveness of just imagining these qualities to be good, it becomes necessary, as the great master Rongchenpa says, is that not to see loving kindness, compassion, or joy and equanimity as four qualities distinct and separate to choose and to then impose upon one's own self, but to be able to see that you are going to be nothing but loving kindness and compassion, joyfulness and equanimity if your attitude is as vast as the space. The analogy of the space here is a sense of attitude being vast. Vastness as opposed to linear perspective. Linear perspective being everything begins with yourself, in the middle is about yourself. It ends with yourself. When the perspective of your own attitude begins to become vaster, and just as space is able to be accommodating to everything, space just as it is accommodating to something pure as well as impure, something that is right, something that is not right, something that is your own, something that is not your own, something that is of your doing, something that is of not your doing. Just as the space accommodates all perfections and imperfections. The basis of loving kindness and compassion or any equanimity and joyfulness will only arise when your ability to rest in your own self is within an attitude that is able to accommodate others as they are. That there is no demand, there is no expectation. Particularly, you do not approach cultivation of kindness as being strategic, and you plan how you are going to apply that loving kindness and compassion. So therefore, in cultivating the four qualities, the four immeasurables, first thing to work on is to just hold your own attitude, to be able to cultivate a vaster perspective to things such that the mind itself resembles that of space. Just as the space is able to gently, freely, without any demand, hold everything, if you and your attitude towards others, and whether it's your friend, whether it's your family, whether it's your community, whether it's generally the whole world itself, if you're able to simply hold a perspective that is accommodating and that is not constantly trying to demand according to your own expectations, what is that attitude other than loving kindness? What is that attitude other than compassion? Then there is no need to go out and be compassionate. You are compassionate. There is no need to then remember loving kindness and to do loving kindness. who you are is naturally a loving person because the basis of your attitude is such that there is much more acceptance. There's a sense of accommodating of the others. In the same way, think about cultivating the second quality, where there is constancy, where the nature of your own mind is constant as the depth of the ocean, as it says. Depth of the ocean that is not deterred by the waves on its surface. In the same way, good moods and bad moods, good experiences and bad experiences, your nice day and your bad day do not influence the potential of patience, potential of kindness that you do hold in that vast perspective of your own mind. Given that the first quality of attitude being as vast as the space is what we understood to be good. But then you must strengthen that vast attitude that is all accommodating by not letting it be influenced by everyday occurrences, everyday experiences. And so where there is a strengthened awareness to holding that vast perspective, where the determination to be able to be gentle in your approach to the others is not overwhelmed by occurrences that you do experience in your everyday, then you are cultivating a constancy in your nature that is similar to the depth of the ocean. That strengthens the attitude that is all accommodating, and in that way, there is a sense of dependability, that there is able to be trust in your own self as being a source that sentient beings or others can depend upon for your love, for your kindness. Now, when that doesn't happen, then I think it's the common sort of problems that we all have. I think especially Buddhists who are Mahayana students try very hard to be compassionate, to developing loving kindness and so on and so forth. Their intention is excellent, but their constancy is not always excellent. And therefore, when their moods or when their different kinds of experiences in life occur and happen, and your own and yourself become a sort of, at a certain moment, very crucial, then very often the self and the self-absorption wins over the determination to practice loving kindness and compassion. So forgetfulness very easily comes by, where the same habitual patterns gain much more stronger, overwhelming power over the determination to practice loving kindness and compassion. Therefore, it becomes essential to first look at the cultivation of this depth of the ocean-like constancy in one's own self, and then from there on to make it much more strong. Because saying one's own mind has to be as constant as the ocean is one thing. But how can you make it is through the cultivation of the third characteristic or the third quality. The attitude or the insight that sees phenomena, your own inner phenomena of thoughts, feelings and emotions, as well as whatever is happening on the external world called the external phenomena, as the third example, mists that arise, that manifest, and that dissolve. If the insight, the wisdom aspect of knowing the nature of things as they occur, is thoroughly kept in mind, particularly one of the most singular, powerful characteristics of every occurrences of phenomena, and that is transformation, change. Where everything arises, it manifests, it sees, speaks about things change. There's an impermanent nature. Where there is something good, that changes. Where there is something bad, that too changes. And therefore, through that clear understanding, if the relationship to what is occurring within your own mind in the field of thoughts and emotions can be seen from the insight of knowing, this will also change, then it does not dramatically make the problem disappear, perhaps, but it definitely loosens the tightness with which otherwise our mind holds them to be unchanging and permanent and constantly. And when it holds on to it tightly, imagining it's never going to change, that's what makes the moods, the emotions, the feelings, or the external experiences very, very overwhelmingly powerful. But although you do experience whatever inner or outer experiences or emotions that may be occurring, if the mind is able to view it as a mist, in that yes, it has the momentary appearance, but that it also changes, just as hundreds of occurrences have changed, thousands of emotions and feelings have changed, this difficulty will also change, does enhance the abiding in the constancy, which then enhances the vastness of the attitude to remain much more stable within one's own self. Now, from therefore developing the vastness of the attitude, depth or constant as the depth of the ocean, and being able to see mind and its occurrences of various emotions as well as external experiences as transitory in nature, then cultivate the fourth quality of genuinely having a gentle approach towards others as evenly as the rays of the sun. That there is, just taking the example of the sun, just as the sun is able to evenly, whether appreciated or not, whether seen, recognized or not, it is able to be accessible for whoever might benefit from it. In the same way, if the determination of the person is to be able to have that constant, gentle giving to the others, without a strategy, without an ambition, without a plan, but as however might be best beneficial to the others, then one is beginning to embark on the path of cultivating the quality of the four immeasurables. And to support that is the most important, the fifth quality. One will never be able to be a kind person, a compassionate person, and yet ignore negativities in one's attitude and personality. Therefore, negativities of anger, negativities of confusion, negativities of self-absorption, negativities of strong desire and attachment, self-clinging, negativities particularly of jealousy and pride, these should be considered to be like dust. When dust enters your eye, you are not able to tolerate it. You do everything that you can to remove the dust from your eye. In the same way, a person has to be so consciously aware that these negativities are that what destroys the absolute goodness intrinsic of one's own self, that is the basis of your developing a sane relationship with the others. Therefore, beginning to work with the concept of compassion in Buddhism begins by first working on the cultivation of these five foundations. When these five foundational sort of attitudes that support and complement each other begin to be stronger, then such a person is said to be one who has laid the foundation for the cultivation of what are called the four immeasurable qualities: loving kindness, compassion, joy, and equanimity. Called immeasurable, not because of science or measurement. Immeasurable is simply defined as being, referred to being as immeasurable because it has the one fundamental quality, unconditional. Unconditional loving kindness is what makes loving kindness immeasurable. Unconditional compassion is what makes compassion immeasurable. Unconditional joy is what makes joy immeasurable, and likewise, unconditional equanimity is what makes equanimity immeasurable. In the classical philosophical texts, immeasurables, these four immeasurables, are sort of mainly classified into two cultivations. Four immeasurables that are cultivated with the object of your four immeasurables being sentient beings, which means you practice loving kindness with the sentient beings being the objective. You're loving kind to sentient beings, you're compassionate to beings, You're joyful in the happiness of the beings, and you're resting in equanimity without discrimination and bias, being the sentient beings, being the basis of that discrimination. If the approach to cultivation of the four immeasurables are on the basis of the sentient beings being the objective, it is called limited four immeasurables, and are methods of development of these qualities that are relative, provisional, conventional, or in simple words, for ordinary practitioners. The actual approach to the cultivation of four immeasurables, which make it much more suited to its unconditional nature, is called cultivation of the four immeasurables just because. Now, of course, for Buddhists, it's more easy if I say that's cultivation of the four immeasurables with the dharmata as the objective. Then, if you're a Buddhist, you know what I mean. Now, if you're not used to Buddhist terminology, what does the word dharmata as the objective mean is just as what I have said. You're developing the four immeasurables for no reason at all. Now, for no reason at all sounds a little bit, I don't know. It could go in a direction where it's almost sort of left in a puzzled state. That's not what it is. But there is no particular reason, just because. You can and you should. It's a quality so intrinsic of one's own self. To be joyful is a quality. Do you always need a reason, a profound reason to be joyful? We could say something like the Buddha will take you to the Buddha fields if you're joyful. And as stubborn human minds that take great pride in calling itself wise, stupidly, however, is conditioned in such a way that it doesn't allow you to take a simple, now this time simple in a good way, not simple in the bad way, but simple in a good way, as a, just as it is, with the same thought. Loving kindness is who you can be. Is there any reason needed to be able to manifest what is your natural nature? And therefore, to be able to develop loving kindness just because. To be able to be compassionate just because. Not because the Buddha pushes you or the Dharma instigates you or there is a big profound reason, but just because you're able to do it. Why not? To be joyful just because. To be in equanimity just because, or would you otherwise just run around being discriminating and pious and partiality and, you know, clumsily always making judgments and opinions when you're not required to interfere in the lives of the others? It's your choice. And so therefore, the actual authentic approach to, from the Buddhist perspective, Buddhist teachings perspective, why we refer to these four as four immeasurable is because of the unconditional loving kindness, compassion, joy, and equanimity that you can generate because it's your natural quality. The confidence that recognizes this and the confidence that allows you to bravely be without there being any profound reason other than the fact that it is your natural nature, that is called the supreme, the absolute, the ultimate four immeasurables, as it should be correctly understood. However, we often like this idea, but we're not going to do it. You're not going to be easily persuaded to being nothing but kind where there is nothing to obtain at the end of the line. Even if it is something as elusive as nirvana, if you're generating the four immeasurables and someone on this seat says, if you would develop loving kindness, compassion, joyfulness, and equanimity, and the fruition of that is nirvana, enlightenment. And perhaps out of that reasoning, most of us have become Buddhists. I have become a nun and a Buddhist and a practitioner in search for that what we call enlightenment and nirvana. But the fact is, I have no idea what it is. Somebody somewhere told me it's a good thing, isn't it? And that seems sufficient. And so as far as the wisdom and the kindness of the great masters have been, is to sort of play along. There's a 3 stages of development. Not doing anything, doing something, and then doing it right. Isn't it? Now, when you don't do it right, do something. This is at least better than not doing anything at all. So search for this nirvana, which we can barely even spell correctly. Isn't it? But in the meantime, if you are moving from point one, which is not being loving, not being compassionate, being grumpy all the time and discriminating, if you can change that to a little bit fabricated kindness, because at the end you'll get nirvana. Or if you're going to be a little bit less biased and more at peace intrinsically in search of that enlightenment, it's good. That fabrication is permitted to continue with the hope, of course, that at some point it'll strike your mind to say, by the way, what's that nirvana all about? And at that point, together with all the supportive different reflections and your own introspection especially, that there comes a point where you can say, there really is no reason needed to being what I'm capable of being as a human being. That I have not recognized that quality, that is a cause of sadness. That we are so distanced from our own potential to being able to cultivate this quality that is intrinsic, that itself is remarkable. So when you look at the stupidity of not having recognized, the ignorance of not recognizing what you are capable of doing, and not only not recognizing, but the repercussions of that, the consequences of that, of this hesitancy, suspicion, aggression, animosity, unkindness, selfishness, self-absorption, to a point where one person cannot trust another person's love completely these days. When you begin to look at that consequence, then you begin to say, going back doesn't mean any sense. Therefore, what you can do is to simply work with your own inner qualities, that it is your quality, and it makes sense to personify, to be able to embody that quality. It is with that hope that relatively we do engage in what is called relative or fabricated producing of loving kindness, compassion, joyfulness, and equanimity. In that regard, what I mean to be pointing out is that, yes, in Buddhism also, there are lots of forms which are deliberate, which are very form-oriented, which look very pretentious, pretentiously sitting in equanimity, in meditation, pretentiously being joyful, lovingly kind, or compassionate. But on the other hand, there is wisdom even in that fabrication, in that it is far superior to ignoring that capability completely. But it is a reminder that needs to be there for all practitioners to know that fabrication or the true naturalness of these qualities are entirely dependent upon your own perspective. Whether you would do it without an incentive, just because, or is an incentive, no matter how invisible or elusive it may be, that is still going to be the driving, motivating factor for you to continue on the path of the work. And that is what determines formally engaging in Buddhist meditation versus being a natural Buddhist. Earlier, as I said, at a certain point, even the designation of Buddhism no longer is relevant, because these are mere labels, these are mere designations. If you need them, use them. If you don't need them, you're actually better off without. So therefore, when we study the 4 immeasurables, these are the 2 streams it will take. It will take to the study of developing 4 immeasurables with Dhammata, just as it is, as the objective, or the sentient beings as being the objective. Now, because as I said, simple as it may be, many of us won't be able to just be without a reason. It would be good. But if you do need a reason, then that is what brings philosophy or commentaries and teachings and meditation techniques in the cultivation of the 4 immeasurable qualities. So therefore, one very simple approach to it is you can develop four immeasurables, the Buddhistic way, where there are things to meditate, things to think about, things to reject, things to cultivate. Or there is the development of the four immeasurable qualities that does not need a philosophy or any systematic approach. It is your own intrinsic quality that you are capable of developing. Choice is yours, but don't take the shortcut just because it's a shortcut. Shortcuts are often simple and short, but extremely difficult for people like ourselves who are conditioned to complexities. And therefore, where complexity is what we are very fond of, let's spend another half an hour or so on the complexity of the four immeasurable qualities. Now, in that way, when we talk about four immeasurable qualities, loving kindness, compassion, joy, and equanimity can be better understood if you look at not what it is, but the opposing factors that impede your natural nature to being loving kindness, compassion, and so forth. This, in accordance to the teachings, especially the commentary of Longchen Pa, is defined as being divided into two studies. What could be in English translated as characteristics, and probably also another one would be is characteristics or opposing factors to the quality that we are speaking about, as well as a certain attitude that does not allow these good qualities to develop. Therefore, for loving kindness, for example, what is loving kindness? Then the definition could be better understood by saying what opposes loving kindness. The characteristic that opposes loving kindness is said to be the retaining and fondness, not only retaining, but a fondness for negative habits or mental states. In the text, it often refers to being happy that you are stingy, finding tremendous logical reasons to why you should be selfish, finding tremendous amount of logical reasons in your own mind why you should be stubborn, why you should be impatient. And we all say that. We say things like, if I am not an impatient person, people will treat me as a doormat. If I am not stingy, who will think about me when I'm old? If I am not upset about something, how will people know not to take advantage of me? So we find good reasons to why we should be maintaining or harboring negative mental states of mind, where stinginess or being territorial or being stubborn or being irritated or being anxious, being fearful, being hopefully are almost in our own mind equated with being sensible, thinking about your own self, protecting your own self. Now, when these habits, what are called negative mental habits, are continued to be maintained within one's own self, the build up of that is the destruction of a good quality, which would be loving kindness. Or if we say, if these negative mental states were destroyed, if you let go of that stinginess, if you let go of that irritation, if you let go of that stubbornness, then through the removal of these negative mental states, what would arise would then be nothing but loving kindness. In short, there is no independent thought or an emotion called loving kindness. Loving kindness simply is the absence of these negative mental habits, and therefore the attitude that is then closely associated as being an attitude opposing or contradictory to loving kindness is simply called exclusivity of the self. It's where the self is continually kept as an exclusive thing. And the issues and the needs as well as the protection of this exclusive self becomes the very sort of criteria most important factor, then that is the attitude that has absolutely difficult or absolute difficulty with the generation of loving kindness, or the destruction of that exclusivity of the self itself is referred to as being loving kindness. In the same light, compassion is then said to be inability to break free. The characteristic of compassion is said to be found in the opposing characteristics, which is called inability to break free from habitual patterns, and therefore inability to break free from the habit of anger, inability to break free from the habit of ignorance, or from desire, pride, and jealousy. Primarily the five root poisons, as they are called: anger, desire, ignorance, jealousy, and pride. Inability to break free from their habit. Now, the difference between the loving kindness and compassion, difference between mental habits and the habitual patterns here that we are talking about, is in the context of mental habits, we are talking much more about mind, aspiration, thoughts. And in the context of inability to break free from these habitual actions, we are talking about actually engaging in the action of being angry. That you are an angry person, constantly angry, not able to overcome anger. That you are a desireful person, not able to really free oneself from the habit, the abject habit of being very desireful. Your own needs, your own attachment, your own passion itself becoming so dominating that it influences any mark of sanity or awareness of the needs of self and the others. Such when there is the dominating tendency of inability to break free from the habitual patterns, that is said to be the characteristic completely in opposition to what we call compassion. Therefore, if we are saying something such as, I would like to develop compassion, how can I become a more compassionate person? The answer is very simply, stop being angry. Loosen up a little bit with your desire. I'm not going to say completely give it up, because that might be very, very optimistic. If you can, of course, that's very good. But loosen up a little bit with that desire, all expectations. Particularly be a little bit more alert with your mind. Alert in the sense of being attentive to the needs of the others around you. Be a little bit less jealous. That's the best thing. And you could probably live life with different moments of time through the day without carrying your ego and pride with you all the time. Now, in being able to simply let go of this, then is said to be the generation of nothing other than compassion. And the attitude that is very closely associated as opposing to compassion is said to be indifference. So just as in loving kindness, the opposing attitude is cherishing of the self or the exclusivity of the self, compassion is designated as being, or the attitude opposing to compassion is said to be nothing other than indifference. So therefore, to check whether one is compassionate or not, in simple words, is to see whether you hold in your attitude indifference to the needs and the happinesses of the others or not. If there is a strong indifference, there's lacking in compassion. If there is compassion, one does not then have the momentum or the sort of the tsunami or the drowning factors of indifference in one's own attitude. That's a good way to always examine within one's own self. Then in regard to joy, now in the text there's a very interesting phrase which I can translate as in a sort of a loose translation, which says, an unhappy state of mind that dwells in its own unhappiness to such a degree that it cannot be sympathetic towards the others. This is then said to be characteristic of a person that is in opposite contrast to the generation of joy. So when we say, what is joyless to not have joy? Or how does joyfulness become impeded? Then it is good to give it a thought and to think about this phrase, an unhappy state of mind. And this unhappy state of mind is not necessarily because many misfortunes have fallen on this. If there is a reasonable reason why you are unhappy, let's say a loved one has died, or you've just gone bankrupt, you've lost your job, or you're sick, or something like that. That's a reasonable reason why you should be unhappy. That's fine. We're not talking about an unhappy state of mind because of these reasonable reasons. We're talking about an unhappy state of mind that just is unhappy because it's so full of self, where there's a pessimism. And those are the states of unhappiness that we create in our own mind, mainly because of discontentment and dissatisfaction. You have a good family, and yet you do not appreciate that. You have friends, you don't appreciate that. You have learning, you don't appreciate that. You have the abilities, you don't appreciate that. You are able to do many things, you don't appreciate that. There are some people we meet every day in our life where you cannot give them any good news because nothing works. That's where there is, and when you look carefully into why is this person suffering so much? Because in some ways you can see, if you have a human body and a life, that itself is tremendous good news, isn't it? You talk to a limbless person about the joys of having limb. When you see people, for example, who are absolutely without hands, without feet, getting on with their machine, wheelchair, I think, for example. And then on the same side you see, and I'm going to take a Buddhist as an example here, because depressed Buddhists is something, a phenomena I've never understood much. Isn't it? Of course, the person has no money. Of course, the person has lost his partner, or the house is not working, or you're below your mortgage payment, and so on and so forth. Yes, there are problems. But then you compare it with a four-year-old dying of cancer, for example, or a mother who cannot provide food for her children for that evening. And you're sitting in meditation, utterly sorrowful about your own self. There's something to think about human mind that does at a certain point go into so much of self-absorption that it creates its own state of unhappiness because of lacking in greater attitude of seeing the world carefully and more fully. Where the self and the pleasures and the pain of the self dictate how you are going to look at the world, and how you are going to look at what life is. A linear approach that is so full of one's own self, that is what is meant by an unhappy state of mind, so self-absorbed in its own self, that such a mind can never develop sympathetic understanding and attitude that understands others. And here, the attitude that is said to be the exact opposite of joyfulness is therefore cynicism. Cynicism and being critical. That outlook, when the attitude is of being critical to everything, when there is a cynical approach to life, to who you are and towards the others, such a person then is one who does not understand or appreciate the generation of the quality joyfulness. And the absence of these two, self-absorption that does not allow you to look at world as it is more clearly and beyond the linear projection of one's own self-interest, and one who is able to let go of that cynical attitude in life, is someone who is by nature then nothing but able to begin to develop joyfulness in one's own self. Now, in the same light, equanimity. Equanimity is said to be an imbalance occurring. Now the text says, imbalance in life that occurs due to extreme passion and aggression. When the passion in your life about anything is very strong, when the aggression to that is very strong, and particularly in the teachings it talks about the passion that makes you hungry and crave, and the level of expectancy just keeps on increasing. And that increased expectation never leaves sort of aggression very far behind, because you're constantly restless whether or not what you are expecting is going to be achieved. And so therefore, that rejection, what we call expectancy and the rejection aspect, when it is very much in your life, your expectation is very strong, and your whole focus of your living is driven by expectation, and there is enormous aggression where that expectancy is not met. And even if it is met, then you're very territorial about it. Then that constant imbalance brought about by this passion and aggression. And then the third is confusion. Not knowing that the more you increase passion and aggression, it boomerangs back to you and makes you even more hungrier and even more aggressive. And that it keeps turning against you, and never knowing that it turns against you and sustaining the confusion about it. Whether life and the imbalance of life is created by the extremes of indulgence, of passion, aggression, and confusion, these three factors, then it is said to be a state in exact opposite or contradiction, contrast to equanimity. Equanimity is lost when one is subdued by these. And of course, the attitude of that of the equanimity is said to be bias, where these impulses of the passion and aggression and confusion also then are not very distant from the bias. You're very partial to whatever serves your expectation. You're very biased against anything that comes between you and your expectation. The aggression itself fuels the bias. And so therefore, it is when studying the development of these four immeasurable qualities, it's always very important to particularly study those little aspects that oppose the cultivation of who you are as a human being. So in some ways, we could say four immeasurables are not four qualities. Four immeasurables are who you are. You are a loving person. You are a compassionate person. You are a joyful person with an absolute potential, natural potential of equanimity. But should you then, instead of delving and exploring these natural intrinsic qualities of your own, and be subdued instead by its opposing factors, exclusivity of the self, indifference, cynicism, and bias, if you just take these four, then you will find that the preoccupation with these four are what then creates oneself being distant, and then to such a point where, ironically, you have to study something called Buddhism to actually begin to understand what these four qualities are. I always feel that it is one of the most ironical things. It's actually a slap across one's own cheek to be able to come to a point where you have to relegate yourself to religion or any philosophy or meditation, and in some cases even being locked up in caves for years before you come to a point where you say, oh yeah, I could be more loving, I could be more compassionate, I think joy is something I could do easily, or that there is inner peace that we could tap into, that natural resource within our own selves. So give it a thought, because really all this complexity that we are trying to build in life is, I guess, entertaining. Of course, it gives us something to speak about on a Friday night. But beyond that, you know, it's just making things more complex, more distant. And that is, unfortunately, the biggest loser in this, the biggest damage that you bring to is to your own sanity, your own potentials. So therefore, thinking about it in this way, and then cultivating. Now then, of course, we come to the main part of the four immeasurables in the text. For example, the layout is such, where you begin to then say, okay, so this is the definition, the defining characteristics of what the four immeasurables are. How can we develop? How can we cultivate four immeasurables? So a person, let's say someone who so fond of complexity that even this much of simpleness may not be sufficient. So someone has to be told, how should I meditate on the cultivation of the four immeasurables? Then we can make it a little bit more complex now. Now, to make it a little bit more complicated, loving kindness can never be practiced by anyone if you do not practice what are called the seven stages of gradual development of understanding. In Tibetan, we often say these seven are referred to as knowing all sentient beings to having been one's mother, first. Second, reflecting upon their kindness. Third, reflecting upon how you can repay with gratitude all the kindness that you have received from the others. Fourth is said to be a gentle approach towards the others, the first expression of repaying your kindness. Fifth is said to be compassionate attitude, or what is also called sympathetic attitude, that fortifies or strengthens your gentle approach in relating to other sentient beings. Sixth is called the quality laksam, we say in Tibetan, which could be going beyond what you think are your limitations, going beyond your own limitations to be able to generate greater warmth, greater sympathy, greater concentration in the needs for the needs of the others. And ultimately, an ever-present, constant, pure attitude. These seven qualities are said to be indispensable for anyone who says, I would like to cultivate loving kindness towards the others, beginning with regard all sentient beings as your mother. And that has to be taken literally. I have myself, throughout my Buddhist life, which is since my birth, I guess, struggled with this. You know, you go through the text which says, see all sentient beings as your mothers. My question to you is, do you do it? How do you view it? Because when I talk about my own experience, I will always say, I always thought being brought up in a Buddhist background, I'm taught to regard all sentient beings as my mothers. But truthfully speaking, it's very theoretical. You think all of them? And there's a certain amount of disbelief. Of course, for those of you who don't even believe beyond one life, it's an astronomical sort of a belief probably. But for someone like me who does believe in life after death and many, many lifetimes, thousands and countless of lifetimes, even for this Tibetan mind, to think all of them, even the ones you don't like, or especially the ones that you don't think about. You look at a caterpillar and you think, look, have you been my mother? Isn't it? Now, why I'm pointing this out is, we don't spend enough time with this. When we don't spend enough time with this thought, closeness of relationship and interdependency is not understood. Point here is not about life and death. It's not about reincarnation. It's not about many lifetimes. Believe it, it's fine. If you don't believe it, that's also very fine. But as I did say, take it very literally, is that how are you imagining that you could ever generate love for another person if you had always the attitude of patronizing, what you call patronizing attitude, that you are the do-gooder to someone, that you are the one who is giving, without having given thought that you may be the recipient of so much, that your giving of love could just be the minimal expression of your expression of gratitude for what you have received. The point here is about understanding interdependency. And therefore, a very easy approach would be is to think who you are today, what you have become as a person, what you have achieved, and who you are able to be as even a comprehending individual. If it were not the collective kindness of thousands and many more individuals who brought you into being, your education wouldn't be an education without the others giving it to you. Your understanding and learning and capabilities, your skill, your birth itself could never come into being if it was not a contribution of the others. But does a human mind think about it? When a human mind doesn't think about one having been the sort of gathering of all the kindnesses of the others, it begins to then develop a sense of associating developing kindness as almost a sort of a favor that you are doing to somebody else. Therefore, to reverse that, it becomes very essential to really take time. Don't jump, don't be in a hurry to practice kindness or compassion. First, understand gratitude. Be able to take time to really reflect upon the interconnectedness with all sentient beings to a point where we can say a glass of water could never be independent of at least no less than 50 or 100 individuals having contributed to it being produced on the table today in front of me so that I can drink it when I need it. To have the sort of the gateway to the loving kindness is to be able to be observant about this fact. Then think about kindness, not just a sort of a superficial, cursory kind of a reflection. Oh, they have all been very kind to me. I don't know in how many ways, but they must have been. But to be able to really again here, instead of practicing kindness, instead of doing any kind of meditation, actually spend time thinking one by one all the kindnesses that you have received from the others until you develop the third is almost a sense of urgency of having to do something in being able to then repay that kindness with certain gesture. That diminishes the play of arrogance in expressing kindness and compassion. Because what you are able to project as kindness and compassion merely becomes the simple, minimalistic sort of the very minimal gesture that you are able to express as appreciation for the thousands of gifts that you have received from the others. And so a humble approach to the practice of loving kindness arises, which then is the first step into making it unconditional. Otherwise, it does not become unconditional. It gets limited in being unconditional. Then after that, these three, mother, dhamma, tinso, as we say, reflecting them upon them as your mother, thinking about their kindness, then thinking about ways to repay that kindness, then develop only after that warmth in one's own attitude, which is probably the main characteristic of loving kindness, as is most evocative in its own term in Sanskrit, which is Maitri. And Maitri is friendship. Develop friendship with others. If you don't develop friendship with the others, you'll never be able to develop loving kindness and altruism and compassion. Therefore, friendship, being able to have warmth, a gentle approach to the others, cultivating that, then giving it momentum by developing its fifth quality, and that is sympathetic attitude. Where there is sympathy in the needs of the others, where there's a mind that wishes happiness and the causes of happiness in the others. And then let it grow. Let that warmth and sympathy grow to such a degree that it is not limited but by what you think are your limitations. And that's the biggest impediment to making loving kindness unconditional and immeasurable. And that is where you let your limitations impede your potential. I'm not able to do it as much. I don't have the time, you say. I don't have the resources. I don't have the skill. And we come up with all kinds of many different impediments that limit our ability to have genuine loving kindness for the others. Therefore, to practice cultivation of loving kindness is to not let yourself be impeded by the limitations. Do a little bit more. If 1 hour today, 2 hours tomorrow. If extending to just your family, extend it to extended family. If you're extending it to your community, extend it to other communities. If you're being tolerant today, be tolerant better tomorrow. But whatever it is that there is growth, there is going beyond your own limitations or what you think are your limitations, and do that with the pure attitude, which is the seventh. And pure attitude is very simple. It's without ambition, without expectation. Where there is no ambition to your expression of kindness, where there is no expectation of gaining something in return, without a strategy, without an ambition, without any kind of an expectation in return, not even recognition of that gratitude, where you're able to truly just simply be nothing but kind, because that's the least that you can do for the others, for everything that you have received. And your consciousness and your mind is alert in knowing the needs of the others. And you push yourself to going beyond your limitations as best as you can. Such would be then cultivating the first immeasurable qualities, loving kindness. Now regarding compassion, it's a long topic and I have to hurry and finish this up in 15 minutes now. So I'm going to read out to you 9 things that you might need for compassion. So when you say, I'm going to be compassionate, what does it mean? It simply means you have to be delightful. That's the first thing. You can never say something like, I'm going to be compassionate towards all sentient beings and look ferocious, for example. Isn't it? So being delightful here simply is being gentle. Gentleness in your demeanor, gentleness in your physical actions, verbal actions, gentle attitude towards all, such that there is a genuine delight in being of help to the others. That would be compassion. Second, you'd have to be courageous. To have the courage to go beyond your own hesitations, your own insecurities, your own expectations, your own personal self-cherishing ambitions. And at the cost of these, yet still if it is something that you can do that will alleviate the suffering and the causes of suffering of other sentient beings, then that would be the generation of compassion. Then is to be pleasant. The third characteristic is to be pleasant. That where there is a sense of being pleasant, you who you are as a person is a pleasant person. That is the characteristic. Yidoma we say in Tibetan, which is translated as being pleasant. But Yidoma also means, in a sort of a loose translation, is someone who seems very accessible to the others. For being able to be compassionate, you have to be aware of who you are as a person, such that that gateway to openness, being accessible to the others, is a quality that you're able to cultivate within your own self. So therefore, being delightful, being courageous, being pleasant, being disciplined, so that you don't do it just for one day per week, but that the discipline allows you to keep a consistent diligence and effort, that you are able to be determined in your motivation of compassion for all sentient beings. That then is the fourth quality. Fifth is joyfulness. We've sort of talked a little bit about it earlier here too. But there is a wish that is constantly removed from yourself. Joyfulness is where the attention is removed from yourself and is transmitted only to the happiness of the others. It does not see and balance happiness as what you can sort of experience or what you can contribute to. For example, joyfulness would be as simple as being happy in the happiness of the others, which may not have anything to do with you. You may not have contributed to it, but that you can be just as happy for the happiness of the others, wishing others to be happy always, removed from suffering. Then it's said to be stern, is the next quality. To be stern and firm. Here in the text it says, this sixth quality of sternness comes, where if it is for the goodness of the others, you can actually be strict in saying no if it is truly helpful for the others. And this is then opposing what is called idiot compassion. So you are compassionate, and sometimes in our run to be compassionate, we let wisdom of discrimination take a break. Not doing that. But to use your own wisdom in being able to locate what is the greater goodness of the individual. And if in saying no or not being kind, the greater good of the person is able to be achieved, then not hesitating is also called sternness That is also one of the qualities of compassion. Seventh quality is then said to be nothing but utterly kind. And this then again is much more deeper than this sort of the sternness that we have been talking about. Being utterly kind is simply making sure that in your expression of compassion, there is no place given to your own personal ambition, that there is no hidden or even a very small water of agenda, self-fulfillment, in that expression of kindness. If that is able to be achieved, then that is also said to be developing utterly kindness. Beyond hesitation, where one is trying to cultivate compassion, it has to be, again, carefully thought of in such a way that habitual patterns will always arise. Therefore, whenever your habit arises, habit of self, self-cherishing, habit of expectation, habit of protection of your own arises, that there is the courage that propels you to being able to go beyond hesitation. That is then said to be the eighth characteristic of compassion. And the ninth is said to be where that compassion is utterly unbiased, truly unbiased, where there is no greater compassion for those that you get along well with, and lesser compassion for those who are against you or someone that who doesn't live up to your expectation, or vice versa. Sometimes, again, it's in the other situation where you're trying to be more compassionate to those you have difficulty with, and you have lesser compassion for those who you are very near to. And that's where most of the people try to go and be compassionate far away in the third world rather than be compassionate at your homes, for example. And therefore, being thoroughly unbiased in your approach. Now, these nine: delightful, courageous, pleasant, disciplined, joyful, stern, utterly kind, beyond hesitation, and unbiased, called the nine expressions of life. In various forms, those of you who are artists, for example, various forms of art, whether music and particularly in dancing, these are the nine expressions that are used in the Eastern tradition, often called the nine expressions of life. Why they are enumerated in the context of the four immeasurables, particularly compassion, is to be able to take life and the generation of compassion as expressions of that life. Everything that you are doing in your life, happy moments, sad moments, moments that are where you are by yourself, moments where you are with the others, moments where things go your way, moments where things do not go your way. Whatever you are experiencing in life, if everything is channeled into may others be free from suffering and the causes of suffering, then such a heart is said to be cultivating compassion. In this way, then, developing compassion is something that needs to be cultivated, and likewise with joyfulness. Now, joyfulness is simply the antidote to this kind of a sort of a belief that many people who practice compassion and loving kindness sort of unconsciously fall into. And that is where you take on tremendous pressure on your own self, where you think that now the happiness of everyone else depends upon you. Joyfulness is to be able to have a larger perspective to knowing that beings find their happiness without you also. And therefore, one of the greatest factors of practicing joyfulness is said to be finding happiness, your happiness, in the happiness of the others, and particularly in those moments of happiness that have nothing to do with you. So if a person is beautiful, let's say, and you have not done the makeup of this person, you still be very beautiful. You still be very happy for the beauty of this person. If another person has achieved some good success and it has been done without your contribution, then finding the reference of your happiness in the happiness and the achievement of the other person. Now, as simple as we may say it, give it a thought, because this is one of the most difficult practices, especially for spiritual people, who will begin to, at a certain point, develop an unnecessary tension where you think happiness has to pass through your approval. Isn't it? And therefore, we are happy when we have done something. We are happy when we have been able to eradicate the suffering of somebody else, but that it has been done on their own without your contribution, and we don't have any feelings about it. Versus if you're jealous, of course, you know, or it makes you insecure. But even the sense of being indifferent to the happiness of the others, this is the factor which gives birth to cynicism. And that's why more and more sometimes spiritually inclined people and learned spiritual inclined people are the most unhappy people. Why so is because their learnedness makes them very critical. This is right, that is wrong, this shouldn't be done, that's the way to do it, there are three things to do it, four things to abandon, five things to cultivate, that's not the nature, this is the true nature, that's relative, this is provisional, that's definitive. We're very clever in sort of seeing where the rights and the wrongs are, but what happens is the immense concentration in exercising your discriminating mind backfires sometimes to creating a critical attitude in life where you do not see goodness in the others. Where you do not see goodness in the others, and particularly where you stop interfering in particularly when you continue to interfere in everything, then that is the source of unhappiness and agitation. And this is then what is called an unhappy state of mind that is unable to be sympathetic to the others because it's so full of its own self. Therefore, to practice joyfulness is to constantly be observant in all things that are good, that are nice, that are correct, that are an accomplishment in the others, and to associate your happiness not with your achievement or what you have done to the others, but to reference your happiness in the accomplishment of the others, and particularly in the accomplishment of the others that have had no contribution from your own self. If you find two people greatly in love, be very happy for them. If you find a person who's very learned, be very happy for their learnedness. If a person meditates better than you, be happy for the other person. If the other person seems to be a better human being, be happy for that other person. If somebody is beautiful, be happy for that beauty. And that's why I always say, as a Buddhist, if you are meditating and two people are talking very loudly outside the room, instead of meditating, be very happy. They have something to talk about. If a cell phone rings, instead of becoming irritated because you've been disrupted from generating loving kindness to all the mother-like sentient beings, you know, be happy that this person is remembered by someone and is giving him a call. So being able to sort of change the perspective of what we mean when we talk about loving kindness and compassion becomes very necessary. Although, of course, none of these qualities can be compared as being one better than the other, but I have always, and many of the learned great masters have always taught, that joyfulness is perhaps one of the most pivotal qualities of all the qualities. If there is basic contentment from where joyfulness arising from a good attitude arises, loving kindness and compassion are never far behind. You take joyfulness out of that mind of the person, then even loving kindness and compassion that you may practice and try to breathe out to all the sentient beings and share and learn all the different kinds of slogans and techniques and meditation, well, it's a fun exercise that will give you some sense of fulfillment of having done something. But to what degree will it actually transform and transcend your mind? That's very doubtful. And therefore, joyfulness in the accomplishment of the others, and all this must be founded upon equanimity. Equanimity beginning from not being discriminating, not being biased to those that you love, get easily along with, are agreeable to you, it's always easier to take that as being so important that you distance yourself from those that you don't get along with, that differ from you, that are different from you, or have harmed you, even worse, harmed you or hurt you in certain ways. Where there is a discriminating and a bias that's constantly there, then it never makes the generation of any good quality sincere and absolutely pure. Therefore, not developing bias, not having discrimination, is very important. Now, so much as far as we have spoken about, I think for about 2 hours or so, is all about developing four immeasurables, with the objective being sentient beings. This is then what is called relative approach. This is the objective, very objective oriented. It is always good to practice and develop these qualities in these ways, better than not doing anything. But the actual study and the practice of the four immeasurable is beyond this. And this is what we earlier talked about as generating four immeasurables, where the objectiveness is not a reference, but it is just because it's your natural quality. Philosophically or textually speaking, it is called where the objective is dhammata, the natural nature of your own mind. Now, when four immeasurables are taught in the context of this approach, knowing your nature to be nothing but kind, knowing your nature to being nothing but compassionate, knowing nothing but your nature to being joyful, such an approach begins the practice of four immeasurables, not from loving kindness, compassion, progressing to joyfulness and equanimity, but it progresses from equanimity. The first that you practice is equanimity. Resting your mind closer and closer to its own innate nature. Where it recognizes its own innate nature, such is then the flow of nothing other than loving kindness, compassion, and joy. And therefore, these are the two prevalent ways in Buddhist teachings how the four immeasurables are taught. Mahayana teaches the four immeasurables primarily by approaching objectiveness of the sentient beings to gradual progress until it comes to the point where it realizes equanimity, there being your own nature, and therefore the fabricated four immeasurables becoming completely natural. In the very essential philosophical approach, such as the Madhyamika Mahayana techniques, and primarily what are today called the Vajrayana methods, then the second approach is very predominant, where the nature of one's own mind is introduced, such that it says if one knows one's own nature to be such that is nothing other than kindness and compassionate, and that one's own nature is equanimity itself, then there is no reason for the person to study, to sort of classify and have the philosophy of all the four immeasurables and so on and so forth. That is then called the meditative approach. Today, when people talk about developing meditation or doing meditation or learning to develop mindfulness and awareness and so on and so forth, then you should always keep in mind that what you have undertaken is this very essential approach of knowing the nature and through this being able to illuminate the qualities of kindness and compassion. Now, whether you do it this way, whether you do it the progressive way, that choice is entirely left up to every individual practice. And this is what brings the diverse approaches to the study of Buddhism. You can study Buddhism to get to the point, you can get to the point and study Buddhism. You hold the nose this way, you hold the nose that way, it doesn't really matter so long as you hold the nose, as you say. So therefore, through this one single topic of the four immeasurables, one can see that there are different approaches. And each of the approaches are entirely left open to people and their own inclinations. And according to one's own inclination, according to one's own aptitude, according to one's own capacities and what makes sense to you, all of these different routes can be undertaken. But ultimately, it gathers into the single essence. You have the capacity. If you recognize it, that is called Dhamma. If you don't recognize it, then that's simply called ignorance. So, I'll stop at this point and simply say thank you to everyone, especially the study group here, as well as all the people who have helped, and of course members of this place of wonderful place of house of worship, and say thank you to everyone. Please practice the four immeasurables, complicated way or the simple way. That's entirely up to you, so long as you do it. So, thank you. Good night.